The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. In our first article today, they're going to use, the author frequently uses a term, in fact, it's in the title, of broligarch, which is a slang term meaning a small group of bros or men who control a situation or a political power structure. And this was written by Brooke Harrington, a sociology professor at Dartmouth College. 8 years ago, the PayPal and Palantir founder Peter Thiel was an outlier in liberal Silicon Valley for publicly supporting Donald Trump. But now, a member of prominent male tech plutocrats who previously opposed the former president have done an about-face. These broligarchs are publicly endorsing and donating to the Republican candidate and revealing a lot about their own priorities. The Wall Street Journal recently reported that Tesla CEO Elon Musk, who according to his biographer once waited in line for 6 hours to shake Barack Obama's hand, was planning to donate $45 million a month to a super PAC supporting Trump's campaign. Musk later denied making the offer, but he reiterated his support for Trump, despite the former president's effort to overturn the 2020 election and his criticism of electric vehicles. After backing Joe Biden in 2020, Musk has grown sharply critical of Democrats on a range of issues. Meanwhile, the venture capitalist Mark Andreessen, who once blasted Trump's anti-immigration politics, recently endorsed Trump on his podcast, arguing that the Republican nominee's policies are better for tech startups. Another prominent venture capitalist, David Sachs, who supported Hillary Clinton in 2016 and said after the January 6th riot that Trump had disqualified himself, hosted a fundraiser for Trump in June, circulated a list of Silicon Valley luminaries supporting the ex-president and urged others, "Come on in, the water's warm." Sachs maintained in an open letter that the Republican ex-president would be better on the economy, foreign policy, and border security. Trump's consistent lead in the polls, at least until President Joe Biden dropped out, might also help explain the broligarch's change of heart. Many business leaders cozy up to politicians who seem likely to win. But another motivation seems obvious, a desire for power without accountability. Noblesse without the oblige. Trump promises massive tax cuts and looser regulation. That's good for the broligarch's pocketbooks. It's also a stark contrast with the Biden administration's stricter enforcement of antitrust laws, its crackdown on cryptocurrency scams, and its stunning turnaround of the IRS, which, after stepping up efforts to catch rich tax cheats, recently announced it had recovered $1 billion in past due taxes owed by high-income, high-wealth individuals. While tech libertarians were happy for Biden to bail out their failing finances, last year his administration saved Silicon Valley Bank and several broligarchs by lifting the limit on federal insurance for deposits. They are not so keen on government when it constrains their ability to grow richer. I am a sociologist who studies the ultra-rich. Over the course of 17 years of research, I've heard repeatedly from financial advisors that multimillionaire and billionaire clients view themselves as above nationality and laws. One wealth advisor told me that some of his clients sincerely believe that they are descended from the pharaohs, that they were destined to inherit the earth. This mindset comes through in a 1997 book that Thiel has listed among his favorites of all time, The Sovereign Individual, by James Dale Davidson and William Rees-Mogg. The text unironically likens the author Rich to the gods in Greek myth and assures readers that they deserve no less than world domination. Commanding vastly greater resources and beyond the reach of many forms of compulsion, the sovereign individual will design governments and reconfigure economies. In describing why he included the book, Thiel said that it offered a prophecy of a future that doesn't include the powerful states that rule over us today. Thiel has famously argued that freedom and democracy are incompatible. To many billionaires' dismay, democratic governance involves taxation, regulation, and scrutiny by the free press. The same system that facilitated their prosperity through the rule of law and good economic stewardship also constrains them, as it does all of us. But hell hath no fury like a broligarch who doesn't get his way. That's how the rich really are different from you and me. Some of them, particularly Silicon Valley CEOs, see any form of democratic constraint on themselves as illegitimate by definition. Rather than participate in the compromise and turn-taking that are second nature in democratic societies, they say, "Don't you know who I am?" Their sense of entitlement cannot be understated. For example, Musk allegedly soured on Biden when the latter didn't invite him to a 2021 White House summit on electric vehicles. Musk publicly bemoaned the cold shoulder he received. His friend Jeff Skoll, the billionaire former eBay executive, went so far as to accuse Biden of persecuting our entrepreneurs. Other billionaires have made even more absurd claims of victimhood. In 2014, the venture capitalist Tom Perkins likened media criticism of the Silicon Valley elite to Kristallnacht, the 1938 Nazi pogrom against Germany's Jewish population. But for all their rejection of taxation, regulation, and press scrutiny, the broligarchs are not anarchists. They're in full support of the laws protecting their property rights and enforcing their contracts. They use public goods such as potable water, well-maintained roads, and police protection. They're just not keen on being subject to the law, doing their part to keep government up and running, or acknowledging their dependence on a free, functional democracy for their prosperity. To counter Musk, Sachs, and other pro-Trump Silicon Valley figures, more than 100 venture capitalists announced Wednesday that they will support Vice President Kamala Harris's bid for the White House. But even broligarchs who support Democrats seem to bristle at public oversight of the tech industry. The LinkedIn co-founder Reid Hoffman, a major Biden donor who signed the VCs for Kamala statement, has urged the vice president to dump Lina Khan, the Biden-appointed Federal Trade Commission chair who has argued for more aggressive antitrust enforcement on tech companies. Tech plutocrats of all ideological stripes try to bend the political system to their wishes. The author Michael Lewis told 60 Minutes that Sam Bankman-Fried, the former cryptocurrency tycoon who was convicted last year of defrauding customers of billions of dollars, considered paying Trump $5 billion to stay out of the 2024 presidential race. Among the broligarchs' defining traits is an undemocratic conviction, made explicit by some, that their ideas should prevail regardless of the preferences of their fellow citizens. "Competition is for losers," the headline of a 2014 Thiel op-ed in the Wall Street Journal declared, a sentiment that extends to the competition of ideas and policies on which democracy depends. To some, the politics of the new pro-Trump broligarchs might seem short-sighted, but they do not rely on public schools, Medicare, Social Security, or other shared initiatives. If all of those institutions, created and maintained through representative democracy and the tax contributions of generations, disappeared tomorrow, the billionaires would be fine in the short term. In fact, they would be better off because they could keep for themselves the relatively small share of their wealth they now pay via their taxes to support those institutions. And if the nation becomes a crumbling ruin, with cratering health and education levels, or roads and bridges falling to pieces, then what of it? In the short term, broligarchs can adapt to local anarchy, as the ultra-rich of Brazil and Mexico have done, using helicopters to commute a few blocks to work or to ferry their children to school, high above the crime-ridden streets where their fellow citizens must struggle to survive as best they can. In the long term, when their adaptations cease to protect them, they can retreat to the luxury of underground bunkers, complete with bowling alleys, or even to outer space. The ultimate displays of wealth and power are the space travel projects that might someday allow Musk and other broligarchs not only to escape the laws of the state, but to escape the planet entirely. Slipping the surly bonds of society, they could leave the rest of us to maintain the democracies that brought them their prosperity. Next, Why We're Banning Phones at Our School, by Russell Shaw. In the early 1960s, when my parents were in high school, they received free sampler packs of cigarettes on their cafeteria trays. To the cigarette companies, it made sense. Where better to find new customers than at schools whose students, being children, hadn't yet established brand loyalties? This is hard to fathom in 2024. I believe that future generations will look back with the same incredulity, at our acceptance of phones in schools. The research is clear. The dramatic rise in adolescent anxiety, depression, and suicide correlates closely with the widespread adoption of smartphones over the past 15 years. Although causation is debated, as a school head for 14 years, I know what I have seen. Unfettered phone usage at school hurts our kids. It makes them less connected, less attentive, less resilient, and less happy. As the social psychologist Jonathan Haidt has written for this magazine, smartphone-based life alters or interferes with a great number of developmental processes. It is time to remove phones from schools. At the entrance to our high school is an indoor amphitheater we call the Forum. The space acts simultaneously as a living room, dining room, library, and town square. When making my rounds during the school day, I will often stand at the top of the Forum and observe our students in their natural habitat. A group of sophomores plays hacky sack in one corner, while a lone senior leans against the wall reading Moby Dick, highlighter in hand. Students share a pizza. A duo prepares for an upcoming chemistry quiz. It is a hive of activity. One visitor to our school described the atmosphere as having an intellectual crackle. That was a decade ago. I still make my rounds, and yes, many of the above activities still unfold in the Forum. But they are being crowded out by students looking at their phones. The students are sitting next to one another. They may even be interacting. But more and more their attention is on their screens. Watching phones take over the Forum brings to mind a beetle infestation in a forest. At first, just one or two trees show signs of damage. The next thing you know, the forest is less healthy, less vibrant place than it once was. I've watched students who struggle to make friends not learn how to, because they can retreat into the short-term safety of their phones rather than tolerate the discomfort that often precedes finding one's way into a conversation. I've watched some of the spontaneity that makes school fun diminish, because students are less tuned into what's happening around them. I've watched our community become weakened by the ubiquitous presence of phones. Good conversations are hard. They are messy and complex and require attention and careful listening. Phones teach our students to abandon the eyes of the person they're speaking to in order to glance at a newly arrived text or Snapchat message. They privilege simplistic dichotomies that can garner likes rather than nuanced understanding, which requires the patience to turn to a topic again and again. suspending judgment. They undermine the very skills we aim to impart, the ability to engage deeply, to hold complexity, to build meaningful community. I am not a Luddite. I believe in the ability of technology to enrich our lives. And yet I believe that those who are responsible for the well-being of children can no longer ignore the reality that phones in schools are doing more harm than good, distracting students, isolating them, and creating unhealthy echo chambers that undermine critical thinking. To be clear, adults are not setting a great example. In a middle school graduation speech a few years ago, I encouraged our students to put down their phones. Their parents applauded, and then, without missing a beat, the students called out, "You put down yours." We too are often glued to our devices, distracted at meals, at sporting events, while standing in line. Adults would do well to set their own limits on phone use. Some people argue that phones prepare students for the pressures of our digital world, one they'll eventually have to navigate anyway. Even if this is true, and I am not sure it is an unintentional after-effect that happens at the expense of building community. Others argue that in the age of school shootings, it's important for parents to be able to reach their children at a moment's notice. When we practice lockdown drills, like most other schools, our security team instructs students to sit quietly, to silence and put down their phones. School shootings are a growing and terrifying reality. At the same time, far more young people die by suicide each year than by school shootings. While I understand the parental impulse to know you could communicate with your child instantly and constantly, protecting children's mental health is far more urgent than keeping tabs on them. In fact, developmentally appropriate freedom from parental oversight is vital for healthy adolescents. But that's a topic for another day. And giving them a respite from technology so that they can more deeply connect with themselves and with others is one crucial way to protect their mental health. In a world in which information is readily available and AI is evolving at a stunning pace, schools must focus on teaching attention, navigating ambiguity, encouraging independent thinking, and nurturing communities. These essential tasks are hindered by phones, which fragment attention and weaken our capacity for genuine connection. Our school already bans phones for pre-K through 8th graders, and starting this year, we will no longer allow phones in the high school. I expect that some of our students, and even some parents, will vigorously protest this change, and yet I believe that most will grow to embrace it, discovering that their experience of school takes on a new depth and vitality. For too long, children all over the world have been guinea pigs in a dangerous experiment. The results are in. We need to take phones out of schools. Let's reclaim our school spaces and ensure our students learn not just from devices, but from one another and the world around them. So much of the magic of childhood happens in unmediated community. We must not deprive our children of that gift. Russell Shaw, the author, is the head of school at Georgetown Day School in Washington, D.C. Next is a reprint of a science article from September of 2019. A woman's ancestry DNA test revealed a medical secret by Sarah Zhang. In 2017, Holly Becker took an ancestry DNA test, and the results, she would only later learn, exactly matched those of a young man in New York. This was strange, but the test was not wrong. She really did have his DNA inside her. 2 decades ago, she had undergone an umbilical cord blood transplant to treat her non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. The anonymous donor's cells became her cells, and they still course through her body today. That is what the ancestry DNA test had picked up. On a recent Sunday, Becker, now 45, met her donor, Patrick Davey, age 25, for the first time in Chicago. They laughed, they embraced, they told each other their life stories. Theirs is the first public case of a patient meeting their cord blood donor. For nearly 30 years, donations from infant umbilical cord blood have been strictly anonymous for ethical reasons. But mail-in DNA tests have now introduced a way to circumvent the policy, even inadvertently, as in Becker's case. "We just didn't think technology like this would exist and this scenario would arrive," said Joanne Kurtzberg, director of the Carolina's Cord Blood Bank and a pioneer in cord blood banking. But now it has, and Kurtzberg said it was sure to come up at a cord blood meeting she happens to be organizing in Miami. Becker and Davy's connection began 25 years ago, shortly after he was born. His mom agreed to donate his umbilical cord blood, and for several years his cells lay frozen in a cord blood bank in New York. Meanwhile, hundreds of miles away in Chicago, a 24-year-old Becker started getting fevers and night sweats and extreme fatigue, symptoms, it turned out, from non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, a cancer that affects white blood cells. She went through multiple rounds of chemo. They all failed. "I was literally at the point where I was about to die," she says. That's when her doctor suggested a then-novel transplant involving cord blood from a stranger. Umbilical cords are rich in hematopoietic stem cells, which ultimately give rise to all different types of blood cells. To do the transplant, doctors would destroy Becker's own cancerous cells before infusing her with hematopoietic stem cells from a healthy, matched donor. Those cells would eventually divide to replace all the blood in her. It was a grueling procedure, and Becker did not fully recover for 2 years. But she has stayed healthy ever since, and she always wondered over the years about the anonymous donor who saved her life. Her doctor told her the donor was untraceable. That's how it's supposed to work. And when Becker finally spit into a tube for her ancestry DNA test, she was not trying to find her donor. She did not even know that was possible. She was just interested in her family history. But the test matched her to Patrick's mom, Dania Davy, who immediately messaged Becker when she saw a new and very close match, so close as to be mother or daughter. Davy, who is adopted, had recently found her birth family through ancestry DNA, and this new match made no sense. She knew her birth mother. She certainly knew Becker was not her daughter. They both thought the test was wrong. Becker wondered about the transplant. She asked Davy whether she was from New York, because that was the only fact she knew about her cord blood donor. Davy said yes. When Becker shared her hypothesis with her oncologist at Loyola Medicine, Patrick Stiff, he was initially skeptical. Transplants with hematopoietic stem cells, which can come from cord blood, as in Becker's case, or from bone marrow, should only alter the blood cells in her body. Then Stiff told me he heard from yet another transplant patient who got strange results. The DNA in saliva, it turns out, can come from cells in the cheek lining, which should have the recipient's DNA, and from the white blood cells, which should have the donor's DNA that guard against bacteria in the mouth. Ancestry DNA and 23andMe actually advise customers who have had bone marrow and cord blood transplants against taking their tests, as the mix of genetic material can cause them to fail. Often enough, though, the tests return the genetic results of the donor. Many bone marrow recipients have gotten their donor's DNA results, and Stiff said he knew of at least one other unpublicized case of a cord blood recipient who found their donor. To confirm that what everyone now suspected, Patrick Davy took a DNA test. He did, in fact, match the original records for Becker's anonymous donor. So for all these years, the two strangers had had this unusual bond. To receive cord blood is to carry forever someone else's DNA inside you. To donate cord blood is to possibly have someone out there, unbeknownst even to you, walking around with your DNA inside them. Adult bone marrow and infant cord blood donations differ in one important way, though. An infant is rarely aware that the cord blood was donated. Patrick didn't know until the whole business with the DNA test came up. He wasn't the one who consented to the donation after all, as he had just been born. His mom did. This is what gave pause to Breanne Kirkpatrick, a genetic counselor who has written about DNA tests and bone marrow transplants. It was a great story, a really happy outcome for the woman. Her life was saved, she says. It's more the implications of what that means on a grander societal level. Consumer DNA tests have been used to uncover family secrets and track down criminals. Those investigations can go very wrong if test results are misinterpreted because some people don't realize their cord blood was donated. The cord blood community is taking seriously the implications of donor and recipient contact, too. Kurtzberg says banks had established a policy of strict anonymity, in part because of the fear that sick recipients might try to contact donors to get more cells. Nobody wanted a scenario of a dying patient begging a parent to let them take bone marrow from a young child. This wall has stayed in place even as the first infants whose cord blood was donated have become adults. Donna Regan, a director of customer-ready products for Be the Match, the nonprofit that operates a registry for cord blood donations, says her organization recently reviewed the policy about letting recipients contact now adult donors. The group decided against it because the mothers had been promised anonymity when they consented all those years ago. We've been very rigid in protecting the confidentiality and identity of cord blood donors, says Regan, and she doesn't expect that policy to change. Sperm banks are currently dealing with a similar fallout. As donor-conceived people are finding their sometimes reluctant donors through DNA tests, anonymity has allowed tissue banking to sidestep some of the messy questions about life and death. Anonymity will not do so any longer. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Have a great day.